Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings and welcome again to the ID the Future podcast. This is Casey Luskin, broadcasting from Seattle, Washington with the Center for Science and Culture. We have on our show today, again, Dr. Michael Egnor, who is, as we discussed in two previous podcasts, a professor of neurosurgery and pediatrics at the State University of New York in Stony Brook. And he's also an award-winning brain surgeon who was named one of New York's best doctors by New York Magazine. So as I said in the last podcast with him, if you are looking for a doctor who believes that the brain is not just a random accident and you need, for some reason, a brain surgeon to operate on your brain, you may consider Dr. Michael Egnor as a very strong candidate for being a doctor for you. But we have Dr. Egnor again on our show today because Dr. Egnor, he works very hard at his day job. Sometimes he likes to go around in the evenings and become involved on some of the infamous ID and evolution blogs that are out there. And so I think that Dr. Egnor has some interesting stories to tell us about his experiences on these blogs, because they're not just trivial experiences. Some of them deal with some of the leading scientists, biologists, and journalists out there who purport to represent the Darwinian viewpoint. And so it's worth knowing what a professor of neurosurgery has discovered when he comes at these guys with some pretty tough questions. So Dr. Egnor, thank you for coming back on our podcast once again today.
Thank you, Casey.
Okay, well, I'm aware of a few different exchanges and interchanges you've had on some blogs recently, so I want to just talk about a few of those. First off, let's just talk real quick about your experience on the Time Magazine science blog. Now, what happened there? You went there and posted a comment in response to a blog post that was basically against the Discovery Institute, but you went and you asked some questions. What happened?
Well, I had been interviewed by the Discovery Institute because I was a signatory of the scientists who doubt Darwinism. And I am told honestly how I felt about the science behind Darwinism. And
which we've discussed in some previous podcasts, by the way. So
yes.
Go to our archives. You can listen to those if you want. Sorry, go ahead.
And the senior science writer for Time Magazine, Mike Lemonick, I believe it's pronounced, wrote on his blog about the Discovery Institute's interview with me that this was fraudulent. And I think meant that the Discovery Institute's activities were fraudulent, but I, you know, I kind of took it personally. So I answered him in his blog, and I told him that I felt that these were genuine, honest questions that needed to be addressed, and that it wasn't anything the least bit fraudulent about asking an honest scientific question. So I asked the question in a very straightforward way to him. I said, how much biologically meaningful information can a Darwinian process generate? In any other theory, if you ask a physicist, how fast will an apple fall when you drop it from a tree, he can give you a number. And I just wanted a number from a Darwinist. I wanted to know, if I have bacteria in a culture dish, how much can they change by purely random mutations, by random Darwinian mechanisms? And as it turned out, he couldn't answer me, nor could the host of Darwinists who came onto his blog and tried to answer me. And not only couldn't he answer me, but he first said that my question didn't really matter, wasn't really of interest to Darwinists, which is kind of astonishing given that it's the fundamental question that they're proposing to answer, is how biological complexity arose.
Well, I just want to make a real comment. This reminds me, the fact that he didn't even find that question important sounds just like a famous episode with Richard Dawkins that I believe is recounted in one of Philip Johnson's book, how a TV crew came in and asked Richard Dawkins about how evolution produces biological information, and he said, that's a question that only a creationist would ask. And so it's amazing to find out that these aren't even questions that are interesting to the hardline neo-Darwinist. But I'm sorry to interrupt you. Keep going there.
Well, Dawkins is exactly right. I mean, that's the problem with this debate, is that it is a question that only the intelligent design people are asking. The Darwinists aren't asking it. And there could be two reasons why they wouldn't ask it. One reason would be that they have the answer for it already, and so why bother to waste their time? The other reason would be that they don't have the answer for it, and they know that trying to answer it will greatly undermine their theory, in which case it would make sense from their perspective to try to hush it up. So what I did is I gave them an opportunity to answer it, if they have the answer, and they haven't answered it. There's been a tremendous amount of activity on the blogs regarding this question, and there has been no meaningful answer to that question. It would be as if one asked the scientists who were proposing cold fusion, and you just ask them, well, how much energy did your experiment generate? And they call you names for asking the question. They say it doesn't matter. And they say, you know, who cares? And only a skeptic of cold fusion would even ask the question. You come away from that saying, well, there must be something really wrong with cold fusion. And if a Darwinist can't answer that very simple question, how much biological complexity, measured in any way you wish, information content, whatever, but it has to be meaningful for living things. How much can your mechanism actually generate per generation, per organism? The fact is they can't answer it, and the fact is they don't even know how to ask the question. So how can their theory be a fact if they don't even know how to ask the fundamental question on which the theory hinges?
Sure. Okay, well, let's move on to some of your other blog escapades then, because you then went on to the blog of P.Z. Myers, who is a professor of biology at, I believe, the University of Minnesota Morris, who has a very popular science blog called Pharyngula. As a matter of fact, a survey from Nature, the journal Nature done, I believe, last year, found that his was actually the number one science blog on the internet. So a lot of people read that blog. And he was blogging about this, and you actually went on and submitted a fairly thoughtful, long comment asking some of these same questions about how much information, biological information, can Darwinian processes produce. I'd like to know about not only your reception there in terms of how were you treated, but also did you at least get an answer to your question? So what happened on P.Z. Myers' blog?
Sure. Well, I went to his blog, and I asked him, as one scientist to another scientist, that let's just be honest here. Just tell me how much information you can produce, and if you can't, that's okay. But let's talk about it, because it's a very interesting question. What PZ did was he just went to PubMed, which is a search engine that can be used by members of the public for looking up things in science or medicine, and he just typed in some random things. He typed in gene duplication evolution or something, and he got back 2,000 different papers over the past several years on it. And he said, there's your answer. And I reminded him that I didn't ask how many references can you get when you type gene duplication evolution into PubMed. I asked him, how much biologically relevant information can you get? So I tried it, and I went to PubMed. I actually don't do my science by just typing things into PubMed and counting the references I get. I think about what I do. But I went and typed in random information, complexity, and E. coli, which is a kind of bacterium. And I got back three references, not 2,000. And the three references had nothing to do with the actual question that I was asking. So what he was doing is, frankly, what I think the Darwinists have been doing for a long, long time, and I call it citation chaff. You know, chaff was stuff that that pilots would throw into the air in World War II to try to confuse radar so you couldn't actually see what was going on. And what Darwinists do is they cite all kinds of papers, none of whom actually address the question being asked, and they assume that the person will be so overwhelmed in trying to answer these irrelevant papers that they'll go away. And so I pointed it out to PZ.
So, and you made a comment on there specifically responding to this gene duplication argument that I thought was quite revealing and actually quite witty, and it had something to do with would he accept plagiarism in his classes. And can you just explain the comparison of the gene duplication argument to essentially plagiarizing a paper in a class? What's the connection there?
Well, in response to my question, PZ cited these 2,000 papers, but he mentioned one paper that he thought actually had relevance to my question. And the paper was noting that it was possible for an organism to develop a slightly different kind of biological function by duplicating a gene, by copying a gene and making two copies instead of one copy. And I pointed out to PZ that my question was about new biological information. That is, that organisms didn't arise by just copying themselves, because they would have had to have had something meaningful to start with. And what I said was, if you really think that just copying something means significant new information, then how do you discipline students in your class who commit plagiarism? The student just copies another student's paper. is that like a new paper? And the student could use your argument as a way to get out of an accusation of plagiarism.
It's a equivocation on the definition of new. When you say new, you mean something that actually does something new, that actually does something meaningfully new. And when he says new, he just means, well, it didn't exist before. It's here now. It might be a clone of something else, but, you know, because this clone wasn't here before, it's new. And that's basically it's an equivocation on the definition of the word new.
It's the same kind of thing as going to a bookstore and looking on the shelf and seeing that there are 20 copies of Shakespeare's play Hamlet on the shelves in the bookstore. And if you're an evolutionary biologist, you would arrive at the conclusion that that's how Hamlet was written, was that it was just copied over and over again until you had the play from nothing. What intelligent design people are saying is that we want to know where the biological complexity, the astonishing evidence for design, came from originally. We have no problem with the fact that some organisms may copy it, but where did it come from? Who wrote it is our question. I also pointed out to PZ that would my question make any more sense if I just typed it twice? So I typed the question twice and said, now, do you see my question in a new way?
That's very funny. One final point I'd like to get to here, Dr. Agnor, and this is sort of an area that is unfortunate in this debate. It's sort of the ugly side of this debate, at least as far as the Darwinists are concerned. And it really has to do with the way they treat Darwin skeptics. And, I mean, I remember looking at the thread of comments on P.Z. Meyer's blog, and one that caught my eye the most was a very prominent poster, a contributor to Talk Origins. His response to you was said, we should call them ignoramuses. And I thought, wow, that's a really helpful response there. But, you know, is this the kind of treatment that you saw? I mean, how do these Darwinists treat ID proponents and Darwin skeptics on their blogs? Because I think that a lot of our listeners, you know, either they might not read these blogs, or if they do, you know, we tend to operate as human beings under the assumption that if a person is very emotional or angry, that maybe that indicates that they have really strong reasons for believing what they do. And, you know, should we take that as a sign that their position is strong or a sign that their position is weak? And what's happening? Where are these people at on these blogs? And what does that tell you?
Well, I've been involved in my own scientific research on blood flow to the brain and on the dynamics that give rise to hydrocephalus, which is an accumulation of water inside the brain, for a number of years now. And I've been in debates with other scientists regarding these issues. And the first thing that I've noticed is that scientists who are honest, who genuinely want to find the truth, are delighted when someone questions their theory. The reason is that it allows you to talk about your theory. It focuses attention on it. From a strictly practical point, the worst thing that can happen to a person's theory is for it to be ignored. Right now, we are raising questions about Darwinism that has enormously raised the visibility of Darwinism. The Darwinists should be very happy. P.Z. Meyer's website depends on this kind of debate. Why would he resent people asking the questions that are actually what gives rise to the popularity of his website? What I found is, in my own life in science, is that when people are angry, when you question the science they're doing, it's often because they see the fundamental weakness in their own theory, and they deeply resent what you're doing. People who are confident of their own theories, people who believe in what they're doing, are delighted to have questions, delighted to talk about it. And generally, they treat interlocutors with a lot of courtesy. Because in a way, a person who's asking about your theory, if deep down inside you think your theory is the truth, is doing you a favor. He's giving you a chance to talk about it. So I, for example, if a Darwinist approaches me and asks me politely about intelligent design, I'm delighted to talk about it.
If I can interject, I get emails from people all the time asking questions about intelligent design, and as you say this, that's exactly how I feel too. I feel very honored, and I welcome the questions, and even if it's a common question, I'll say that's a good question, and then I try to address it. And there's really, anger and or trying to hurt the person personally is, really not even on the radar screen. I'm sorry to interrupt, but really you have a very good point there. And I think that people who are involved with sort of publicly defending intelligent design really can relate to the sort of confident and friendly exchange that we often enjoy having with Darwinists.
The kinds of questions that intelligent design scientists are asking of Darwinism are questions that a Darwinist could spend a very productive career answering. The simple question of how much biologically relevant information can be generated by a Darwinian process is a question that teams of Darwinists could spend long, highly productive scientific careers answering. And if I were a Darwinist, I would be delighted that someone asked a question like that, because it gives me work to do. It gives me an opportunity to really prove my theory. And the last thing I do is insult the guy that asked the question.
Yeah.
With the Darwinists, the only thing they do is insult the guy that asked the question. You got to wonder, how much confidence do they have in their own theory?
That's a great way to end this podcast. Dr. Michael Egnor, thank you very much for doing these podcasts with us. It's really wonderful to get your perspective and your contribution, and I'm sure that our listeners have really enjoyed hearing about this. I hope that perhaps we can have you on again in the future sometime.
I would look forward to it. Thank you, Casey.
Once again, this is Casey Luskin with the ID of the Future podcast signing off. It's been great having these series of podcasts with Dr. Michael Egnor, professor of neurosurgery and pediatrics at the State University of New York, Stony Brook. Stay tuned for lots of more interesting podcasts coming up in the future. Thanks for listening.
Music on ID the Future comes courtesy of composer Yuri Mamchur. Visit www.yuriproductions.com and check out his latest CD, In the Harbor. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Discovery President is Bruce Chapman. ID the Future Managing Editor is Robert Crowther. And the producer is Keith Finn. ID the Future and ID Science in the News is copyright Discovery Institute 2006. For more information, visit www.discovery.org or www.idthefuture.com.